I worked with a BIOS assist when I was still doing caregiving at St. Michael's Hospital. I sort of said, you know, I want to be like you when I grow up. And I got to see the types of work that he did. He led debriefs with staff to decompress and talk out and analyze difficult cases. I saw him consulting with patients, families, and teams, leading education sessions. That's so many components of work life that I wanted in healthcare.
I'm Frances Garrett. I teach Buddhism in the Department for the Study of Religion, and we're super excited to have Sean Hillman here. Sean, I've known for many years, as he did a degree in our program in the Department for the Study of Religion. He did a really amazing project on end-of-life care in South Asian traditions, comparing a number of different South Asian traditions and different ethical and practical issues on end-of-life care. He's also lived in India for many years. He's a medical anthropologist and a textual historian, did his doctorate in religion, as I was saying, and also did a collaborative program in bioethics and South Asian studies at the University of Toronto before he moved on to become a clinical ethicist in a hospital locally. He, before that, lived for a very long time in India and is very intimately connected to Buddhist traditions in various ways. He's also served as a prison chaplain, a Buddhist chaplain in correctional systems here. So very interesting background and a lot of practical experience as well as deep theoretical knowledge of the traditions and issues that he's worked on. Sean, thank you so much for agreeing to come to speak to our classes, and we're super excited to learn more about your research and what you've been working on recently as well.
Thanks so much for the introduction. One of my goals whenever I'm talking to students is to demonstrate clinical bioethics as a professional pathway. I'll say now that I think starting in my master's, definitely during my doctorate degree, I basically had my eyes on the prize the whole time to become a clinical bioethicist. I don't know when the moment was when I decided I wanted to be a clinical bioethicist, and it sort of grew over time. So as part of my background narrative, I'm going to show you how Buddhism and religious studies and caregiving and bioethics sort of grew together and then started to intersect and then in some ways started to overlap increasingly. But I belong to the Lakeridge Health System, which is a 5-hospital system in the Durham region. I believe around 700 beds, and I am the lead ethicist. I was having some overlapping coverage from another ethicist, but now she's doing her doctorate, so she's working less, which means that I'm like the sole ethicist, except we all rotate calls. So I'm part of a team, which is fantastic in that we can collaborate on issues, but also we offer 24/7 coverage for all of our systems. We cover 7 systems in the Ontario region. I've been with Lakeridge Health now for 6 years. So I'll give a little bit of the background. And also Professor Garrett mentioned prison chaplaincy. I want to specifically say that I actually am a Buddhist corrections chaplain, which is that even though I see in a multi-faith way a lot of different prisoners in 3 different institutions, formerly now 2 institutions at all security levels, I'm there for the Buddhists. And it's interesting, by institution, some of them allow anyone to come and to services of any faith without having to prove their identity or list themselves as identifying as Buddhist. I enjoy it better when anybody can come, because I'm not there just for the Buddhists. I'm there to just help in whatever way I can. And if that means someone's going to come to a session and learn some techniques that will help them on the inside and with their transition outside, then why not? That's my view. But I am delivering Buddhist services. We do breathing and walking meditation together. There's some teachings and there's some discussions. And also for a while, we had some meaningful movie nights where we showed things like some of the Buddhist class, Little Buddha and Kundun, and then some other movies from other traditions too that have transformational themes. So in the early 90s, I started at U of T, and it was my first opportunity to take courses that I feel like I didn't have much access to when I was doing secondary school. So language studies, had already become very interested in Asian studies and Asian religious traditions in particular, starting actually mainly with China, and then moving more into the Indic religious philosophies and Indic studies. And then ended up taking some Chinese language, eventually started taking some other languages. So was really, in a way, a free-for-all. But in the first year with Professor Priestley, who was my first professor of intro to Buddhism, it was my first really true. I had done a little bit of smatterings of readings before then and had been introduced to meditation, which was sort of a flicked a switch for me in terms of my interest in that and Asian traditions. But it was my first access to academic sources, secondary sources on Buddhist studies, but also primary sources. This course, we had to read some sutras. We had to read some Mahayana sutras, and I still have these texts. I'll mention one of them. There is a sutra called On the Benefits of Being a Wandering Mendicant. When I read that sutra, I was very inspired, and it was the first time I thought that I had wanted to become a monk in this life. It took years for that to happen, but that was sort of the seed. And the gist of what really stood out to me in that sutra was themes of living in community, focusing one's entire efforts on personal transformation, living a peaceful life of non-harm and benefit, and so on. I found it very compelling. And I remember saying to myself, if the Buddha were here now, I would follow him. In my early 20s, I dropped out, and then quite soon after that, became a semi-cloistered monastic. I started caregiving as a means of a livelihood to act on wanting to be of practical benefit to others in my life and in my religious practice, and also to be able to bring in an income for myself to be in this community, and eventually to contribute to the community. First, I was a volunteer at Wellesley Hospital. Now, Wellesley was a significant hospital in its early days. I don't know exactly when it started, but it was serving the elite, I guess, of the Rosedale area, high socioeconomic status communities. And then eventually became focused on inner city health, care for the LGBTQ2S+ community, and also precariously housed, underhoused, and homeless people, and other vulnerable communities like sex trade workers and so on. So a big shift in that facility. I remember us being huddled around the radio to hear the announcement of whether Wellesley Hospital would be closed or not. And we walked around in a daze the whole day because we thought, there's no way in a million years they would close a place that had such groundbreaking maternity care burn unit and also a trailblazing HIV and AIDS unit. But of course they closed it. So I left almost immediately and went to St. Michael's. When I started, I was at first a volunteer and I was taking my healthcare aid course. Around that time, I got hired in the emergency room at Wellesley Hospital, now in the mid-90s, and at the same time was hired in assisted disabled housing. And fairly soon after that, I started on, and this is a really significant unit for me and made a big impact on my future in healthcare, was on a 50-bed unit that had this HIV/AIDS unit, geriatrics, stroke care, and palliative care all together on this an incredible unit, which had an incredible team. I mean, I often say palliative care can be delivered anywhere in healthcare and is. People being taken care of at the end of life, whether it's known or unknown that the end of life is coming. When I did leave Wellesley for St. Michael's Hospital, there was some hesitancy on the part, particularly of the LGBTQ2S+ community, going down to a Catholic facility because of some of the views around gender. And as we know, there's some views and that impacts care on issues at the beginning of life, such as pregnancy termination, and at the end of life, such as medical assistance and dying. But the transition went very well, I think in part because of some of the leaders who came from Wellesley Hospital, champions of care for vulnerable inner city people, brought the ethos with them, and it sort of impacted positively the ethos at St. Michael's Hospital. At this time in my early 20s, quite green, from this fairly sheltered upbringing, thrust into healthcare. I didn't mention this, my first day in Emerge, someone was sitting on the side of their bed with what looked like blood coming out of their mouth, but it turned out it was charcoal because they had ingested something and used charcoal for poisoning. It makes people vomit. And so, right away I was seeing things that even beyond what I had seen in movies. And I'll never forget two ambulance attendants transferring a very elderly, frail woman onto the bed. And she was in pain during the transfer. And they were kind of joking about it. And then I heard them in their area talking about how they had almost caused some accidents. And so day one, I was already worried about the possibility to not give care properly and also to have not great motivations and to talk badly about the patients and other things. In my Wellesley days, I was caring for people my own age who were dying of AIDS, which was very difficult. I remember having to step out of one very powerful memory, stepping out of the room and having to cry, not wanting to cry in front of the patient. Although I am of the sort, I still sometimes apologize when I feel, but I try to, nowadays I do a lot of staff wellness activities, even some mindfulness sessions, ongoing mindfulness sessions for staff at the hospital, particularly during the pandemic, but it predated the pandemic too. And I often say, when I apologize, for feeling, I correct myself and I basically give others permission to feel, especially in healthcare. So I had given myself at that time enough permission to feel, but I exited the room so I wouldn't distress the patient. And I have felt with patients too, when they're going through something. And as part of the healthcare aid role, an assistant role in end-of-life care, in that role, there's a lot of emotional support. Even bathing someone, we have the chance to get to know each other and chat, and a lot of mutual conversations there that that I miss sometimes, to be honest, after I was at the bedside for 20 years. And I miss working as closely with nurses. Mostly over the last 6 years, I'd say I work with social workers, then physicians and nurses, and even leadership managers, directors, and senior leaders, and so on. I'm less so with nurses, but I do spend a lot of time still happily with nurses. They're some of my favorite people. When I entered into the Buddhist context, to the residential monastic setting, I took the first level of ordination, which is called Rabjung in Tibetan, which is basically renouncing the householder's life and becoming a celibate with the promise of becoming a novice ordainee in the relatively near future, as long as one needs. So I took that in 94, and then in 98, I took my novice ordination from His Holiness the Dalai Lama in India. And then in 2001, I ended up leaving a community I was with for 7 years here in Canada. Again, the first level ordination was with a Lama in Toronto, actually, who ended up becoming an abbot of one of the monasteries in South India, Saramay. Third level of ordination was in 2001, after I had left the community and was getting ready to move to India for traditional studies in language and philosophy. I took my full ordination also with His Holiness the Dalai Lama. When I first arrived in India, I lived in a retreat center up the hill. So Dharamsala, where His Holiness the Dalai Lama resides and where the main temple is and his monastery. But up above Dharamsala, there was a retreat center there. So even further above the clouds. And it was a good place to start. I was there for about 6 months, had to contribute by teaching and service because of being a monastic and staying gratis. So I had to move, and I found a hut on the property of a doctor, and I stayed in this hut for 2 years, actually, while I was studying at the Library of Tibetan Works and Archives in India, in Dharamsala, taking both language classes and some language tutoring. And then after 2 years there, I started at the Institute for Buddhist Dialectics. I did their first year of programming. When I came back, I picked up my undergrad degree, which was in East Asian Studies. But my independent project, one of the crucial pieces to finish that, it actually took me 3 years to finish one more year of that because I was funding my studies myself by working full-time as a caregiver, was exploring organ and tissue retrieval using a Buddhist text to see if I might be able to tease out some form of a Buddhist perspective on organ retrieval. My master's, the study was an exploration, it was a case study, an exploration of a Tibetan Buddhist death in a Catholic facility. The local ritualist came in and did a POA, which is a consciousness transference ritual for this patient. I actually knew the patient and their family, and I was a caregiver for them, so there was a lot of overlapping roles, although it was a retroactive study. I didn't do the case study, you know, in real time. And there were some tensions. For example, one is the requirement to touch a body in order to do the death determination as a clinician. And amazingly, we had an oncologist who was a Pakistani physician who I adored. On behalf of the family, I had asked her, you know, can you just sort of like do a cursory glance and not touch the body, because they're requesting that we don't interfere with the body minimally so that we don't impact the movement to the next life. And this is a religious accommodation request. What do you think? And she was perfectly cool with it. I remember her sort of peeking out behind the curtain at the bedside. I was very, very impressed, actually, with her flexibility. There was no doubt that the person, the vital signs were absent at that time. We needed often similar things for Buddhists who had passed away as religious accommodations after death, which is to keep the body in the morgue for 3 days before transfer to a funeral home or elsewhere, which is not always easy to do because there can be a lot of bodies in the morgue and there might not be the appetite to help with such a religious accommodation request, which is one of the things I explored in this study. Not making noise in the morgue or along the way when the body is being transferred to the morgue, that is an exceptionally difficult request to have people get on board with if they don't know any background about religious accommodations, especially in the Buddhist tradition. So I had to work very hard on that. And one of the main things that happened in this case that I explored was that this ritualist came to perform this POA ritual and needed a place to prepare. And there was something we call on critical care units and other units we call the quiet room, which is a place where families can get together themselves to do whatever they need to do, be it anticipatory grief or postmortem grief, or to do some decision-making planning or just to rest. But it can also be used for meetings with providers and families and consultants like myself, for example. We use quiet rooms a lot, but staff end up using them on the side if they're not being used as a place to rest too. So there was a staff member in there when this ritualist arrived and I was trying to facilitate their visit, and they just wouldn't give up the room. It turned out in the end, everyone sort of came on board because we were asking for removing the other bed from the room so there wasn't any noise. And so there was some work that we were asking people to do too for this religious accommodation. So it wasn't easy. In the next part, I'll be talking about my doctoral study, which is called Religion, Medicine, Bioethics, and the Law in End-of-Life Care, South Asian Religious Adherent Perspectives. It is an ethnography with a textual analysis, legal analyses, and media analyses included in it. In order to enter into clinical ethics, while I was still doing my doctorate, when I did a pre-doc fellowship in clinical and organizational and research ethics, I rarely suggest to people to do pure bioethics if one wants to go into bioethics, or let's say health ethics consulting, because most of us come to it as a second career. So for me, my background is caregiving and, you know, academics and so on, and then became an ethicist. It is possible to do pure bioethics programs, but then you might be sort of lacking other lenses that one can bring into the work. We have physicians, social workers, philosophers, theologians, people like myself, medical anthropology, religious studies, all coming into bioethics and, again, bringing our respective lenses, but also collaborating with these different lenses as groups, because it's a small bioethics world. We have a network through the Joint Center of Bioethics at U of T called CORE, of Community Practice. There's an East Regional Ethics Group housed out of Ottawa that I'm a part of, and between the Local Health Integration Networks, which manages caregiving regionally in Ontario, a lot of ethics networks through those too. We're part of the Central East Lynn. In order to even apply for a fellowship, which is recommended, some people can be hired without a fellowship, and there are some short fellowships. I know SickKids offers a sort of short in-house placement type of fellowship. Also, Unity Health Network also has something akin to that. Ours is the only program of its sort right now in Canada, not just because it's 2 years and quite robust, but we have you know, our three partner hospitals, but we are partnered with Mount Sinai, UHN, CAMH, and I think there's another partnership. These partnerships allow our fellows to spend time in different types of facilities throughout their training period, which is fantastic. And with us as ethicists at our sites, but also getting outside of the Unity Health Toronto and the Catholic system, and to prepare the fellows to be able to work in faith-based or non-faith-based facilities. So it turns out I ended up working in a non-faith-based facility for the last 6 years, but had been, you know, in the Catholic healthcare system for over two decades. There is a Master's of Health Science in Bioethics offered through the Joint Center for Bioethics. I think it can be done part-time. I think it's a two-year program, and a lot of physicians actually take this course. I work with some. I also sometimes teach in the MHSC program, particularly a policy and document development and review session to let students in on what it's like behind the scenes to develop and review documents and what these documents actually, what their functions are. I worked with a bioethicist when I was still doing caregiving at St. Michael's Hospital. I sort of said to myself, and then to him, he's actually part of our team and he's one of my mentors, you know, I want to be like you when I grow up. And I got to see the types of work that he did. He led debriefs with staff to decompress and talk out and analyze difficult cases. I saw him consulting with patients, families, and teams, leading education sessions. That's so many components of a work life that I wanted in healthcare. It kind of unfolded itself just out of my interests. And, you know, there was a point in the early days of learning about Buddhism, I didn't know that there were actually, you know, when I first was just reading the text, actually living practitioners. That's how little I knew about the tradition. Similarly, in hospital, I didn't know about this role of a bioethicist. Became, again, increasingly interested in it. And my pet concerns, another pet concern is resuscitation. And another inspiration to want to get into the work to be able to try to actually practically help with these dilemmas. And that is, someone might consent to not being resuscitated or having their heart lungs restarted if they stop, if there's a respiratory or a cardiac arrest. What I was finding was at times, family members, not even substitute decision makers who are either appointed or just by their relationship to the person, there's a hierarchy in our legislation as to who, how you rank potential substitute decision makers, but even just any, say, any other family member, like cousins coming in and saying, do resuscitate them, even though they had consented to not be resuscitated. And clinicians and teams were doing this. And I just couldn't understand how autonomy and self-determination could be so breached. Religion often can feature prominently in end-of-life decision-making, which is maybe unsurprising. We might have a person who's unconscious, and we may or may not know what their religious disposition is, which is often a sticking point. And actually, this might be a good time to tell you about a couple of cases, so that I am speaking a little bit to clinical bioethics and how it intersects with religion. You could have someone, you know, unknown what their wishes or preferences or values or beliefs, religious or not, are. Let's say the family, you know, strict adherence to, we might say, a vitalist religious tradition, life at all costs, for example, or at least they hold that view and they're within that tradition because, as we know, these traditions are not monolithic in terms of their views. And I have had families say, this is, for example, the Catholic position. And then because we're a Catholic in Catholic healthcare, we actually have to be in accordance with the Catholic health ethics, which is determined by a conglomerate of bishops across the country, and it has to be vetted all the way up to the Vatican. We can actually provide some clarity, which is actually, according to Catholic theology, certain things are not impermissible, such as stopping treatment that has already been started or not starting treatment that hasn't been started if the burdens outweigh the benefits. And then when someone says the Catholic position is you cannot stop aggressive medical management if you started it, or if it's time to start it, you must. You have no choice. So this is an area where religion features prominently, and there's room for engagement, especially for people who come in with these lenses. I am sometimes called upon, because of my background in religious studies, for cases that have a particularly sticky part that has to do with religious views and end-of-life decision-making. I really struggle with the term compassion fatigue. When I say it, I usually say that I don't prefer it. So I like vicarious trauma, much prefer that. Well, when I started in caregiving, I had the support of a religious community at the time. So I had my community behind me. I had a teacher supporting me, and had the teachings from the tradition, if you will, supporting me in terms of how to manage my own mental state, and also the big cosmological view about transmigration and so on. Also, karma. These were concepts that helped me get through that early period of experiencing things that were so vastly different and disturbing for the first time. And I have to say, it wasn't easy. And I guess you could say it becomes easier over time. You know, a little bit of gallows humor necessarily in healthcare that, you know, helps with coping. But one thing I'll say now that I do and that I have benefited from in the past, now I lead them, but I'm sometimes a participant too, but I'm mostly facilitating debriefing sessions with staff for these very distressing types of things, such as medical assistance in dying. There's research to show that it is extraordinarily distressing for the clinicians, which are both physicians and nurse practitioners, that can do the procedure of giving a lethal injection to hasten the end of a life under certain criteria being met. And the criteria have changed relatively recently. And the pharmacists that draw the meds for that, and the nurses that help dispense the meds, and through like starting the intravenous line and things like this, that these people need a lot of support. And we've actually tried to build in our systems that it's a requirement to do a sort of pre-brief together to get ready for the procedure, both practically and emotionally, and to debrief after these sessions, again, to mainly for the emotional component, but also practical component, going through the checklist. Is there anything we could have improved or can improve for the next procedure and so on. So I lead, it's one of the, I would say, major things that we do as ethicists, is we lead, increasingly so during the pandemic, but these ethics debriefs. And again, the major parts of it are a chance to decompress, just to talk it out. Some people call them like bullshit sessions, but just merely expressing how one is feeling, and the group allowing the space for people to express themselves and not interrupting. And the fact that it's confidential can be very helpful. Sometimes analyzing sticky issues, either a particular case or ongoing issues. issues and challenges with families, or even interprofessional challenges. And we do some staff solidarity exercises and some self-care exercises, including for me, and not every ethicist would do this, but I actually offer mindfulness. I don't call mindfulness or meditation in hospital. Actually, we just have a new series. It's a virtual series. We call it Focused Awareness. I'm just a little skittish of the word mindfulness because of the mindfulness movement. Very skittish of using words that are typically found in religion, in the secular setting, such as meditation. Although our spiritual care providers, which I collaborate with a lot, for example, on this Focused Awareness series, we kind of leapfrog, I'll do a session, they'll do a session, and so on. They're more free with using such terms like that, but their work, of course, is different in hospital. Another thing we've been doing is facilitated support sessions for redeployed staff who have been sent, not by choice, to other areas that they might not be familiar with. Someone who's sent to an ICU who's only done, let's say, pediatric care, for example. So maybe I'll just going to give you some high-level findings, recommendations from a doctoral study. So the three main chapters that I'm going to be drawing from, the first is on end-of-life decision-making and religion in end-of-life decision-making. The next is going to be the question, main question that I had, to put it loosely, is how, if at all, does religion impact end-of-life decision-making among religious adherents in India? And my main cohorts were healthcare providers and non-healthcare providers within the Jain tradition, Tibetan Buddhist tradition, and Hindus. I went in with the question of how does religion impact end-of-life decision-making, but then one came out of my discussions, which were based on a 100-plus closed question questionnaire, and then about a 30-question open questions part of the interview. But they averaged around an hour up to 4 hours. The second major chapter I'm going to dive into is with regard to medical information sharing or attempts to block bad news. You might be familiar with this phenomenon. It happens a lot cross-culturally, which is don't tell grandma she has cancer, for example. And there's a movie which is called The Farewell. It's about a Chinese family where this is happening, and it's based on a real story where the whole family is trying to conceal the fact that grandma in China, they all go to visit her, has cancer, and they have to keep mum on that. They have to keep it a secret. Give you the findings and recommendations from that chapter. A very short bit on ritual death, because this fasting at the end of life chapter is mainly focused on the Jain practice, which is called Salekhana, but I'm going to talk a little bit about Thukdam, which is a end of life meditative absorption state. The difference between how the Jain tradition has been treated in India with regard to some legal contest of fasting at the end of life being the accusations of suicide or abetment to suicide, especially if frail elderly through coercion. Those are the accusations. And then in the Buddhist tradition, where a remarkably similar practice, but with some significant differences that I think leads to the difference in treatment of the traditions with regard to this practice, whereas Buddhism has not received any negative attention with regard to this end-of-life practice, at least in my experience. And lastly, some findings and recommendations with regard to end-of-life care models, so pain management, hospice palliative care, and medical assistance in dying. Mainly, I was really interested to see what people's exposure and attitudes were with regard to hospice palliative care. So I'll just start from the top, which is end-of-life decision-making. So one of the findings is that with regard to religion impacting end-of-life decision-making for individuals, so informants speaking about their own experience about themselves, more than half of informants felt that religion does indeed influence people's end-of-life decision-making in general. Another finding is with regard to religion impacting end-of-life decision-making, this is healthcare professionals, their view, and verbal answers, almost half of the healthcare providers that I talked to felt that religion does not influence healthcare professionals in healthcare and end-of-life decision-making. But informants are ambiguous on this matter in the questionnaire. So this was another factor just in terms of the method of my study, in that had I not had both the questionnaire and the open answers, I think certain insights would not have come through. It was very helpful, laborious, but helpful to analyze both sets of data. One of the questions I had was, what is the configuration of decision-making? Who makes the decisions? Is it the patient? Is it their providers? Is it their families? Is it some sort of combination? And I found answers were fascinating. So in general, for end-of-life decision makers, informants thought there's mostly collaboration between the patient, the family, and providers. So shared decision-making power and deliberations done together where everybody has a voice. The next most popular configuration after a collaborative model was physicians making end-of-life decisions on behalf of their patients. This is something that would not happen in our jurisdiction because of the requirement to have consent, informed consent from either a capable, meaning mentally capable, able to make the decision for themselves, patient, or if they're not capable, a substitute decision maker who also needs to be capable to be able to make that decision. It would never be a clinician making a healthcare decision for another unless it's in emergency circumstances. There is a caveat to what I just said in that it's life or limb circumstances. We can't get consent from the person or a substitute decision maker in a timely way unless it's known somehow that the person wouldn't want something, let's say like resuscitation or let's say blood products. The treatment can proceed under emergency circumstances and consent needs to be sought as soon as possible from, again, the person who might regain consciousness or capacity or their substitute decision makers. So this is a fascinating one that they feel not only that people prefer it, but that it is actually done in practice where clinicians would make decisions on behalf of their patients without input, perhaps, from patients or their families. And this was followed by a tendency to think that the family and the physicians are often the corner making the decision on behalf of the patient without the patient's input. For themselves, the informants mostly preferred autonomous end-of-life decision-making. So they said if I was to make end-of-life decision-making decisions for myself, I would want to do it on my own behalf. This is followed by equal preference, again, for decisions being made by the patient together with their family, or the doctor and the healthcare team making decisions by proxy, again, not involving the family or the patient, which is fascinating, or a collaboration between all three in this triad of the patient, family, and healthcare providers. Informants overall thought that comfort supersedes length of life. So more important to be comfortable at the end of life than to merely prolong life for its own sake. They also held in general after brain death, life support and being medically maintained was not worthwhile for the sake of merely lengthening life. There's also a preference to be at home while dying. That's one of those findings that wasn't surprising. Okay, so back to religion and end-of-life decision-making. How informants understood what I meant by end-of-life decision-making being influenced by religion, because I didn't want to superimpose meaning. I didn't give like a definition. I wanted to know how people themselves felt about that. So it's actually kind of a lengthy finding because there were so many different ideas on this. Some informants took influence by religion to mean such things as how the person treats others, what actions they would conscientiously object to, such as abortion or medical assisted dying, motivation. Positive emotions or concern towards patients, the ability to endure difficulties such as with patience or forbearance, reaping moral or karmic benefit. I just thought perhaps there might be some religious ideas or practices that would influence end-of-life decision-making. But I didn't reveal this because I allowed the informants to basically speak into their own experience and views. So it's really fascinating to get that answer. Okay, so I'm going to move to the medical information sharing. This is a very exciting chapter for me. And again, one of those chapters, I didn't expect it to happen. And I've been talking about it since because it comes up the request to block bad news. And what I mean by bad news is a terminal diagnosis or a poor prognosis, such as the end of life, perhaps coming in the near future. Because it comes up in our consulting regularly. It is a perennial issue where we're asked, and it's a seminal one for me when I was still in Wellesley. So this was my early days when I was still in my early 20s, just starting in caregiving. We had one case that I'll mention because it's just a fascinating story and it led me to be interested in information sharing in the medical context in general from the outset. Had a family where the mother had contracted HIV during childbirth in India because of receiving blood products. The husband subsequently became HIV positive. One of the two children were HIV positive. Now there's, as you probably know, treatments to reduce and even completely mitigate transmission in the womb of HIV. At this time, the patient had become nonverbal, was contracted, nearing the end of life. Very, very distressing for the team to take care of them, not just because it was a difficult case, but because the husband, who was the substitute decision maker for the patient, who couldn't express her wishes at this time, didn't want the extended family to know the diagnosis of HIV and AIDS, which people are entitled to restrict or determine who receives their personal health information and who does not. Even in hospital, someone can have a lockbox, which means nobody except very specific people can receive any information with regard to their personal health. Didn't want the extended family to know this fact, which meant that we had to say things that were true, but not the entire truth, such as, for example, her having forms of cancer, which is an AIDS-defining diagnosis. There's a form of skin cancer called KS, Kaposi sarcoma. Many people with HIV end up developing this as an AIDS-defining diagnosis, as is a type of aspirational, or as is a type of pneumonia or lung infection. also, what was distressing to the team was that the children who was HIV positive was not receiving care and could receive care to mitigate the impact of the virus. So at this time, too, that started to be concerned about how we have some information that is inferential available for people to connect the dots, like the other visitors who aren't connected to the person, as to what condition the person has. For example, when we hang medications in an IV bag and we have a name of the medication, let's say it's AZT, then someone can infer that the person has HIV. And so to try to restrict this information from going to the extended family, wouldn't it require us to obscure the names of the medications that their loved one was getting? So I think this is something we should do in practice, and there might be places that do it. The only context in which I know where we actually obscure IV bags and as part of that, the names of the drugs, is photosensitive drugs that need to be covered with a brown bag. But I think we should be doing better so that others can't even accidentally see the names of medications that people are receiving. Having pill boxes at the side of the bed, we usually sort of take people's personal meds and lock them up and give them back when people leave, so there's not double dosing and using of meds that the team's not aware of. But if these are left out, somebody can see them. And anyways, this is an ongoing concern. It's a type of information sharing I'm very, very worried about. So what did the informants say about the attempts to block bad news or the delivery of bad news? So the informant said that there were some perceived detriments to patients in receiving difficult health information of the sorts that I've mentioned. Multiple informants mentioned medical bad news potentially bringing worry to patients and causing health status decline. Even some people said that if somebody received information that would be traumatic to them, it could even actually lead to a hastening of their death. Some people felt this way. Some people might feel that this is a reason to not give people all of the information as to their condition if it's difficult information. Perceived detriments to families. The main concern of such informants that spoke to this issue were concerned with families receiving medical bad news, potentially causing distress or worry to them. So one of my informants said that if I were to develop cancer, for example, my family are all in UMDO, they're all in Tibet. I would not tell them that I have cancer because I don't want them, we're so distanced, I don't want them to be away from me and worrying about me and not being able to do anything. As one particular fellow that I mentioned, I remember him mentioning that. Perceived benefits to patients, this might not be a surprise because of our exposure to Buddhist and maybe other Indic traditions. Multiple informants said that death preparedness is the main benefit to receiving a poor diagnosis or a grim prognosis. So not only cons to receiving negative information. My strong recommendation that came out of that particular chapter was asking the patient about their preferences for medical information early and in advance, as early as possible. When people come into hospital, one of the first things we talk about, we don't do it with people that are relatively well, and I think we should still because we don't know we never know what's going to happen to someone when in hospital. If someone comes in, especially with something life-threatening or something that is of any level of concern, we ask what their preferences are with regard to resuscitation. Would you like, if you have an arrested breathing in your heart, would you like it started or not, restarted or not? I think we also should be asking people if there's certain types of information they don't want to receive to respect these cultural nuances. I did a book review of an amazing ethnography that I highly recommend if you want to learn more about end-of-life care in Buddhist Thailand, called The Spirit Ambulance title, End-of-Life Care in Thailand, something like that. It's by Stonington. Fascinatingly, they have a practice where similarly they try to prevent certain types of information being revealed to people, like a cancer diagnosis, to maintain what they call their heart-mind energy, or basically keeping uplifted. And this was the most fascinating part, which is some people are themselves, the patients, are part of that collusion. In advance, they're like, make sure you don't tell me if I get a poor prognosis or a terminal diagnosis, because they're in on this practice of trying to, as a way of experiencing the end of their life in the most positive way, to maintain this upliftment or at the very least some sort of equanimity and not the negative feelings that might come from having this sort of news. Another thing I'll share that absolutely blew my mind in this study was that decision makers on behalf of their loved ones might ask for things to repay what they call a life debt. So they might ask for blood products for the person who may or may not need it actually, or may or may not essentially need it as a life-saving means. Like they might need it to bring up their hemoglobin, but not for life-saving. But as a way to repay the debt of receiving a body with the blood that came with it. It's like these elemental corollaries of certain types of care elementally. Like, for example, I want you to ventilate my mother because she gave me the gift of breath by gifting me my body. I mean, it's just unbelievably fascinating. And I had never heard of these elemental corollaries, and that was, in some cases, driving decision-making, not the need, but the repayment need of the person who's making decision, not the need of the patient. This is the recommendation. Either as a preemptive strategy, or at least when it's unclear whether certain medical information should be shared with the patient and their loved ones or not, it's recommended to ask the capable patient what types of information they would like to receive or not, if such information becomes available down the road. To avoid undue distress, it's better, in my view, to have such conversations early and strategically, so there's not a presumption or inference that there already is bad news to share. So to come to someone when there is a terminal diagnosis, and my family wanted me to come and ask you, what if there's any types of information you wouldn't like to receive, and they might get worried and say, oh, is there something to tell me? Did you find something out? So the recommendation is to do it earlier so that you don't have that sort of unnecessary worry, because it could be the person does not want to receive that information. And people are within their rights to determine what information they receive or not and who receives that information. Obviously, if somebody doesn't have all the information about their health condition, they can't give informed decisions. And so in our local healthcare legislation in Ontario, healthcare is delivered provincially, it's not clear in law whether people have the right to defer decision-making if they have capacity to make decisions for themselves to someone else. In practice, we allow it because we're not going to force them. Actually, we can't force someone to make a decision. We can't even force someone who's an appointed decision-maker to make a decision, because all substitute decision-makers, whether by appointment or, you know, by the hierarchy and the legislation, can opt out. Similarly, a person, it seems, at least as a standard of practice, not necessarily regulated or legislated, can opt out of making a decision and then tell us who we should go to. So that person, the proxy decision maker, needs to have certain qualifications. They need to be available, willing, and capable. But otherwise, we would allow for that in practice. But again, it hasn't been tested in law to the point where we have a determination as to whether it's legally permissible or not. Just a little bit on the topic of ritual deaths. And by that, I mean both fasting and immobilization at the end of life. This was the chapter I mentioned is mostly about the Jain practice of Salekhana, which I've actually been researching since 2010. I did a residential Jain studies program, and that was my study. I was looking at this end-of-life practice. So one of the findings is that Buddhist discipline texts distinguish between active healing and withdrawal of medical treatment. There's the language of passive and active euthanasia. Now, this language is still used in many jurisdictions, but it has fallen out of favor, in my experience, in the North American bioethics context. The terminology that we use preferentially now is withholding care, which is not starting something like ventilating, like mechanical breathing for someone, or withdrawing care that has already been started, similarly like mechanical ventilation. And the logic of the terminology change is to take away the withdrawal and withholding from this concept of euthanasia or mercy killing. This language still in consulting gets used. I hear people tell us that if we were to stop something, we're going to kill the patient. Every third high stakes, challenging end of life family meeting, I would say, I'm just guessing off the top of my head, someone in the family will say something along these lines, that if we were to stop what we're doing, we're killing, and therefore, because it's a form of killing in their view, it is unconscionable and we should not do it. It's meant to sometimes pressure us to continue giving care that may actually be inappropriate and actually entering into the realm of being harmful, not just not beneficial, but harmful. These interferences with the body can delay the natural death process. Even with artificial feeding, there are natural processes that abate the hunger and thirst, the chemicals that are released by the body naturally at the end of life that we may be interfering with if we're continuing to hydrate and feed people artificially by tubes through the nose or right into the stomach by a G-tube. I'm just going to say a little bit about why the Jain practice of Salekhana, which is fasting and immobilization at the end of life, there's different iterations, increasingly strict, of these vows. For example, one in some versions of the vows can still take water, and in some versions of the vow, you don't take anything by mouth. And in some versions, you can still walk around a certain area. And in some versions, you have to be in yogic posture, which is the strictest immobilization type of Jain version of this vow. And why I say that there's such similarity between Thukdam, or this end-of-life meditative absorption state, in which, and you probably have heard about it, but if you haven't, it's fascinating. And there are some scientific data shoring up these what has been historically anecdotal evidence of these experiences of a practitioner or meditator that enters into the death state. Vital signs are absent, but you can have up to 10 days or 2 weeks where there's no rigor or malodor, so the decay does not start, because the idea is that the mind is still present and it is in this deep, very subtle meditative absorption. Of course, that would also involve not eating and drinking and being immobilized if one is in yogic posture. And that's the sort of like loose parallels that I make between these two practices. But in practice, one major difference, and I'm going to give five differences, is that as an emic safeguard in Jainism, permission is required from a religious leader to enter into this practice. You have to be, from the insider's perspective, spiritually ready to undergo the rigors of this practice. And one could be denied permission. Permission is not required. There's no corresponding permission process for Buddhists to enter into the Thukdam state. I often say it just happens. And you might have heard stories of masters basically like stopping talking in the middle of a discourse, and they've entered into their death meditation. There's actually many stories like this. Thukdam versus Salekhana in the Buddhist context is necessarily to be labeled as Thukdam is verifiable by those inside and outside of the tradition by way of observable and measurable unusual physical signs. There is mention of something called bodily luster in some hard to find text actually in the Jain tradition, not yet translated. But no, in my findings, no corresponding anecdotal evidence of this luster or some sort of radiance that happens when one is undergoing this fasting practice in the Jain tradition. Whereas there's much anecdotal evidence of a lifelike lack of decay of someone who is undergoing Thukdam. Solinus' senior tutor, Ling Rinpoche, underwent Thukdam as one example. And his Kalachakra teacher, Kirti Sensor Rinpoche, entered into Thukdam to actually have a picture that I sometimes show in some presentations of Kirti Sensor Rinpoche, who was one of my teachers, to give some advice before I went into retreat in the Thukdam state in yogic posture. There's also in the Jain tradition a lot of advanced publicity about this practice. So householders and monastics both can undergo this practice and historically have and are still doing so. If a householder is undergoing the practice, sometimes the families take out full-page ads in the newspaper about the fact that they are just about to enter this practice or undergoing this practice or have just undergone this practice. And also big celebrations of like sometimes, you know, thousands of people, especially if it's a well-known Jain mendicant. So a lot of attention can be drawn to this practice. And in the case of Salekhana, it seems negative attention from human rights thinkers worrying that vulnerable elderly are being sort of coerced because it's esteemed by the tradition. The worry is that some people feel like they must do this practice, even though they may or may not want to undergo this practice. Another parallel is we have some religious hospices, if you will. One is called Mukti Bhavan. There's a movie about Mukti Bhavan too, which is on the shores of the Ganges in Varanasi, where there seems to be, this appears in my dissertation too, some pressure for people to not eat. And this is in a Hindu context, because there's an idea that it will help with continence or not having one's bowels move when one dies, that not drinking and reducing all one's intake before death, it can help prevent this problem because it's seen as particularly inauspicious. You know, the body naturally does this. I've lost count of how many corpses, and often these things happen because of everything basically just lets go. It's natural. This pressure to not eat and drink worries me. And I think when there's the potential for such pressure, and one of my recommendations in the Jain context is to check voluntariness, like explicitly check for voluntariness before someone can enter into this practice, and also checking mental capacity, because monastics are so esteemed in Jainism. We find this in other traditions too. Even breathing the possibility that a monastic might have some cognition interferences from the aging process or some sort of dementia or something like that is very unseemly and seen as inauspicious to even talk like that. So it was actually maybe a little nervous to suggest capacity assessments, you know, even for monastics, just to make sure, as a safeguard, as an oversight. the terminology is different between Jainism and Buddhism in that Salekhana is referred to by many Jains as a fast unto death. So there's like a consequentialist connection. There's a cause and effect connection between the practice and death, whereas you don't have terminology like this in Buddhism, at least not until retroactively, that the person was in the death meditative state. People can talk about it when it's happening too. And they might call it a fast unto death, but it's not used in the same way. And most Jain materials that are trying to justify the practice, it's called the fast unto death. And my suggestion is if we change the terminology again, it might bring less of the negative attention to the practice. And Jains, as it happens, are disproportionately wealthy, indigenous minority religious group, making them a possible target of criticism out of not good intentions like jealousy or so on, as compared to refugee Tibetans, who are the ones that may be doing this Thukdam practice in India, at least. And lastly, I'll just say there seemed to be a low awareness of hospice and palliative care among my informants. There was a preference for a religious environment for people at the end of life, an aversion to hospice palliative care in that many people stated that they thought that being in a place where people knew that it was their last home or their last destination before leaving this life might make them feel distress and decline. The head nurse and head nun at the hospice in South India told us that they actually don't always tell people that they're entering a hospice, but like slowly let them in on that secret, which starts off as a secret, again, for this idea that it might distress them. There's more palliative support in hospital versus at home, even though there was a preference to die at home among my informants. A lot of people said that they might prefer being in hospital or might prefer their loved one to be in hospital because of the medical and nursing support there that they might not have as much of if they're palliating at home. And healthcare professionals and non-healthcare professionals disagreed on hospice palliative care. Healthcare professionals feeling that their patients would want hospice palliative care, but non-healthcare respondents felt that in general that they wouldn't want hospice palliative care proper. Navalia mentioned that dying is preferred at home. Thanks again very much for having me and for letting me blab on about one of my favorite topics.
Thank you so much, Sean. That was just so outstandingly interesting. So many case studies. I feel like we could listen for hours to these really interesting case studies that kind of illuminate the practical aspects of the research that you've done. Really so intriguing.